Morning.
Good morning. This is Mark Arsenovich.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
Good, thanks. How are you?
All right. Boy, just in time.
That's great.
Nice. Mark, online right now we have Mike Phillips, who is with us on Skype, and we have Dave on Skype, and he's from the UK, and we have a bunch of other listeners out there.
Okay.
We're going to talk about your book, but we already talked about you this morning quite a lot. And you're probably going to get some questions about cis internals, which I hope you don't mind.
No, absolutely.
That's all right. So first of all, this is about your book. I mean, let me introduce you again. Mark Arsenovich works at Microsoft in the Windows Azure product team as a technical fellow. Microsoft senior most technical position. And now you are also the author of the popular Sys Internals Windows Administration and Diagnostic Tools, as well as an author, Zero Day, The Very Real Threat of Cyber Terrorism. Is that a real thing? Cyber terrorism?
Is it a real sorry, I didn't hear that.
Yeah, is cyber terrorism something we need to worry about?
Yeah, absolutely we need to worry about it. Actually, there was a...
Just happened this last few weeks.
Pardon?
It just happened this last few weeks, didn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's just this last few weeks. There. I mean, there's been a series of cyber incidents over the last few weeks that just highlight how vulnerable we are to attacks, especially targeted attacks. But I've got a great quotation from Robert Mueller, the head of the FBI. He testified to Congress this week, and listen to this quote from his testimony. Al-Qaeda's online presence has become almost as potent as its physical presence. Extremists are not limiting their use of the Internet to recruitment or radicalization. They're using it to incite terrorism. Of course, the Internet is not only used to plan and execute attacks. It is also a target itself. Osama bin Laden long ago identified cyberspace as a means to damage both our economy and our morale. Countless extremists have taken this to heart, Mueller pointed out. The FBI, with our partners in the intelligence community, believe that cyber terrorism threat is real and is rapidly expanding. Terrorists have shown a clear interest in pursuing hacking skills, and they will either train their own recruits or hire outsiders with an eye toward coupling physical attacks with cyber attacks. So that's just from this week, and that basically reads like the premise for the Zero Day book.
Go ahead, Mike. Mm-hmm.
No, I was just wondering, your book, can you hear me okay, Mark?
Yeah, I can.
Fantastic. Your book is a novel, but is it really a novel, or is it a warning? Is it a shape of things to come? I mean, where does this really unfold?
You're right, it is a warning. I came up with the idea back in the 2004-2005 time period after the wave of attacks that we saw flow through the Internet. The SQL Slammer and Code Red, these worms that propagated and took down various systems. The power outage in the Northeast was attributed to likely being caused by malware. There were ATMs shut down. Continental Airlines reservation systems were shut down for several hours. The Internet actually slowed down at some point because of SQL Slammer. But all of those were just mischief. They had no real intent for damage or destruction. They were just basically kids in their parents' basements seeing what they could do with a self-propagating worm taking advantage of zero-day vulnerabilities. But, you know, I thought, what if somebody wanted to really make a concerted effort about going after things? What if they released a virus that just really did want to cause some horrible destruction, and they did it in a very sophisticated, stealthy way so that it spread very far and wide? That seems, you know, given these this mischief type of attacks were so successful just as a byproduct, I thought that it would make a fantastic weapon for somebody just aimed at indiscriminate kind of damage, and the obvious candidate for somebody like that would be terrorists. So that's where the book came from, and actually it took so long for the book to get published. I finished the first draft in 2006 that I thought at some point it would become historical fiction, because I think it's inevitable, just like Robert Mueller said, that terrorists are going to be trying to use cyberspace in this way. It's just such an easy tool.
Yeah, and you don't need to worry about catching a bullet either.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to update it after 2006?
Pardon?
Did you have to update it after 2006?
Yeah, I did a little bit. I mean, I had like the one of the main hackers in the book had him described as having found vulnerabilities in Windows XP, and Windows XP is now ancient history, so I had to update that to Windows Vista. Just one thing, but nothing major, fortunately. I was afraid it the whole time that I'd have to update it. I did update it with references to some of the cyber attacks that had occurred in the meantime. The last draft was finished before Stuxnet really came out, so I didn't have a chance to update it for that.
So,
go ahead. Mike, no, go ahead.
So what first things that comes to mind for the end users, what can an end user do to protect their computer and themselves against cyber attacks?
Well, so I'm sure on your show you probably cover a lot of the best practices
right.
all the time, so I'll probably just be reinforcing what you're saying.
So,
one is make sure that you've got good passwords, that especially on your wireless network, that it's not just password or you know, something really straightforward. It should be a secure password. And you should have wireless encryption turned on. I mean, it's just amazing how many people still leave their wireless networks open.
Right.
And that's a fantastic way for viruses to worm their way into your systems. Another is, of course, to make sure that you've got antivirus software and that the antivirus software is up to date. A lot of people get a new computer, it comes with antivirus, and after a year or 2 years, whatever the complimentary subscription runs out, and they never bother renewing it.
Right.
And that's just leaving yourself wide open to easy attacks. The easiest kinds of attacks are the ones that are the antivirus companies have already figured out how to defend, and if you're not taking advantage of that, then you're also leaving yourself wide open. And there's no excuse now not to have antivirus. As a little plug for Microsoft, there's Microsoft Security Essentials, which is totally free. You sign up for it, and then you never have to worry about it.
And we actually recommend that.
You do recommend it? Okay, good.
That's the one that we recommend. And you always have to stress that, yes, there are a lot of other free ones, but none is free for a business.
Yeah. Right.
And
that's
Security
right.
Essentials is.
Yep. I think it's if you've got less than 10 computers.
Right. Well, and most of our listeners would be in businesses like that, yeah. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
If you're talking about business users, to make sure that their end users are not running with administrative rights. And I know that's painful, but that's the way to keep your end users from screwing it.
Right.
Doing a lot of damage to your systems. Another one is keeping your software up to date, of course, and making sure that Windows Update is running, Microsoft Update's running and updating your software, making sure that you always say yes to update Adobe Reader and Adobe Flash Player, which are the two of the primary entry points into systems for malware these days. The RSA attack, for example, was a Flash exploit that was socially engineered. So those are just some of the things. Making sure your firewall's on, making sure you don't have unnecessary software installed, getting rid of the stuff that you're not using just because that's unnecessary surface area.
Right. That's a good point. We really haven't talked about very much, Amnon.
Yeah, but CCleaner and stuff works good for that.
Right, but at the same time, he's talking about going through ad remove programs getting rid of the junk you're not using.
And another one is making sure you've got the latest version of whatever browser of choice you like, whether it's Firefox, Chrome, or IE, or whatever. Make sure you got the latest version of it, because otherwise you're not taking advantage of some of the security features that the newer versions have that older versions didn't.
But, Mark, getting back to the book, I'm really curious. I got to be honest, you're one of my heroes.
That's right.
I've just been a big fan of yours, and when I say a fan, only to the extent that I've seen the work that you've done since SysInternals, because I've been hacking with computers for a long, long time, and you have, I gotta tell you, I don't mind, I'll say this to your quote unquote face, I've said to people, maybe even to Amnon, I said, Mark Rusinovich is the one guy who knows more about Windows than Microsoft does, and of course then they bought you out, but, I'm just blown away by how successful your utilities are, how well they work, and how much time and trouble they save. It's just amazing how well they work. I say that to ask the question about the book, and that is that for people who don't know who you are, and to heck with them, but to people who don't know who you are, how do you deflect the criticism that you're being a conspiracy nut or an alarmist?
Actually, I thought that I would start to hear that after the book came out. I thought that I'd get people saying, hey, you're way off on the deep end with this. It's not a real threat. And I really haven't heard that so much, even in the reviews of the book. So it's not been something that's come up very much. And actually, I think that there are a bunch of reviewers that maybe don't know who I am. They read the bio in the back of the book or whatever, see that I'm a...
Mark, just a second.
I've got, and then
Mark, just a second. Dave, we lost your video, and we're getting a lot of noise from your side.
I'm sorry, it's me. I'm trying to reconnect.
Okay, I'm just saying. Go ahead and
apologize.
Try. All right. Go ahead, Mark. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I was just saying that I really haven't heard your conspiracy nut kind of criticism. A lot of people, I think, are giving me the benefit of the doubt just based on the fact that I am at Microsoft and do have the title that I've got there. And Bill Gates puts on the back of the book, too, which lends me to
it. I don't think it has anything to do with the title or being at Microsoft. I think it has to do with the way you have applied what you know. I mean, I have the greatest respect for you. And I would be disappointed to learn that you didn't write any of that software, that you're just the business guy. But I think I know better. I think you're the guy who was at least 50% or more of the creative genius behind SysInternals and WinTernals.
Yep, I definitely had my hands dirty with that. It was me and Bryce Cogswell, 100% on those tools. Bryce is actually retired from Microsoft, so now it's just 100% me. And those tools are a fantastic creative outlet. It's really rewarding to hear from people like you that the tools are helping you and saving you time. That's what makes it so much fun to write.
Well, I think they are without question it only made sense. I shouldn't say this, but I will, and I mean it in a kind way, both towards you and towards Microsoft. I think that Microsoft buying you out is the smartest thing they could have done because, and I'm saying this again to your face, I said it behind your back 10 years ago, you are the only threat that I ever saw to Microsoft because you understand Windows so well that I know in my mind, and I'm not even asking you to comment on this, I know they bought you not only out of respect, but also from a defensive posture because you really know what you're doing, and I greatly appreciate that.
Well, thanks. Like I said, that's hugely rewarding to hear comments like that.
So tell Amnon what it means to be a technical fellow at Microsoft.
Well, that's a really good question. It actually means it's kind of a vague title. Like I said, it's the highest technical title at the company. It's the equivalent of a vice president in the management side of things. But the profiles for the different technical fellows, there's about 20 of them in the company, are very different from one another. There's technical fellows that are people that you might have heard of if you followed computer history, like Chuck Thacker, Dave Cutler, Gordon Bell. There's those types of industry luminaries that have really shaped the modern computing world. And then there's also technical fellows like Terry Crowley, who's probably not many people outside of Microsoft have heard of. He's in the Office team, their senior most engineer there. And then there's people like me that are kind of more have more modern kind of personas at the company, work in a product team deeply. Like I said, I'm on Windows Azure today, and it's really when you have got that kind of title, you've got a lot of latitude to set your own direction, which makes it a lot of fun. I'm having a blast in Windows Azure. I left the Windows group last summer as I got bit by the cloud computing bug and realized that that's a huge paradigm shift we're going through right now, and wanted to catch that wave.
All right, let's talk about that if you don't mind then. Where are we in 5 years with regard to the cloud? And the reason I ask is that I've had two credit cards compromised in the last 2 weeks. I had one was a debit card, one was an American Express. One of them, the American Express, I just found out about yesterday, because it was compromised at a restaurant in the Atlanta airport.
Holy cow.
And Someone had actually recorded the stripe and was in the process of using a piece of plastic with my information on it at a Target store in Atlanta. Wow. Now, I say that to say cloud computing, I'm beginning to get very, very concerned about cloud computing, even to the point that I think that traveling going forward, I'm very likely going to take cash with me and use the credit card even less.
Well, when it comes to security and cloud computing, if you're talking about the major public cloud providers like Google and Microsoft and Rackspace and Amazon, I mean, one of the things that you've got to look at is, and cloud computing is really something that, from a business perspective, it right now is for businesses this big question, should I trust cloud computing? Well, the fact is that most businesses don't have the time or expertise or resources to put in place the security best practices and monitoring systems, vigilance, and even physical security that big cloud providers, public cloud providers do. And so in most cases, the public cloud providers are significantly more secure in their practices and policies than your typical business. Just because they can afford to dedicate the resources to making sure that they've got fantastic security. And that's kind of one of the promises of cloud computing is that you're taking advantage of scale and you're taking advantage of one company, in the case of Microsoft and Windows Azure, dedicating resources to that versus lots of people having to individually do it. The case that you just pointed out about the credit card, that I don't see that has a direct connection to cloud computing. In fact, that's more just somebody with a magstripe sniffer that's sitting there at that point of sale, which actually there's another book that just came out, which is a fantastic book. I just finished reading it if you're interested in the carding scene, called Kingpin. It's by editor Kevin Paulson at Wired.
Say the author again.
Pardon me?
Say the author again.
It's Kevin Paulson.
Okay.
Q-L-S-O-N. His book is called Kingpin, and it's exactly the story of this guy, Max Butler, who became the head, kind of the kingpin of the carding scene several years ago. His story of his rise and fall. But the technical information in that book covers exactly what you experience with your card being swiped like that. But back to cloud computing and security. Besides the best practice part of cloud computing, I think that one of the things that we still haven't really figured out with cloud computing, public cloud computing, is the whole what happens if there's a compromise someplace.
Mm-hmm.
What laws are in effect? Who can come and do forensic investigations? How is that data handled? There's a lot of things that haven't been really tested in that space yet, and I think that you talk about what the world is going to look like in 5 years. I think for sure a lot of those things will have become more clear because there will be incidents that will force us to come up with.
To deal with them.
Yep, to deal with those kinds of things.
So what do you consider the riskiest online behaviors?
The riskiest online behavior. From a consumer perspective?
Yeah.
So one of them is just doing searches, internet. And unfortunately, there's not much you can do to protect yourself from that other than having great browser and antivirus because everybody's doing searches all the time on all sorts of things and clicking on links, and you never know if you're clicking on a link that's poisoned. You can use some site that's poisoned. Even if it's not the site itself, if the site was hacked, that's mm-hmm. another very popular way that malware is being distributed today is people hacking a legitimate site, installing drive-by, download malware on the site.
Right.
But unfortunately, the riskiest behavior is also the behavior that makes the internet the most interesting.
Porn.
And another one actually is just blindly clicking through dialogues. Some of this drive-by download will actually pop up warnings that say, hey, you're infected. Click this button to get protection or whatever. People have to be very suspicious about any kind of dialogue that pops up from a website and asking you to do something,
right,
or telling you that you've got a problem. That's another, this scareware is another huge way that malware is propagating today.
Mm-hmm.
So just say no, I think, is the answer to that.
Actually, no. You see, now I can help you.
Okay.
No, you cannot say no. As a programmer.
Oh, yeah, close the window. You're
absolutely.
Right.
I tell people that if they have any kind of doubt, they'll be better off actually pressing the power button and turning the computer off. They'll be less damaged than if they somehow got the spyware.
Yep, you're absolutely right. And I should have pointed out that it's not saying no, but you should click the little the X in the upper right hand corner.
Well, I found some people that actually some of these spyware actually programmed their pop-up that no matter where you click on it, it says, yes, please come in and visit me.
But
it's something that you would think that people would figure out that something is wrong here. And we talked about it actually last week about some author that said, if you have, let's say, Security Essentials, how come System Tools is telling you that you have a problem?
Right.
You should be aware. Yeah, you should be aware of what you're running. But I'll let you continue. So what else is risky?
Well, I actually think those are the two riskiest. Well, another one is just if you've got children, having your children share the same computer as you. That's another risky one. Or if they're going to share the same computer, not having them in lockdown accounts without administrative rights.
Right, so they should have
their own.
Why
is that a fact?
Because as much as you can tell them not to click on the dialog boxes or not to open attachments that come from their friends saying, hey, watch this cool video, they're going to do it. Better safe than sorry.
Mark, if you have just a few more minutes, and don't mind us gushing a little bit, let me ask you a question.
Let me just remind our listeners that we're talking with Mark Rusinovich, the author of Zero Day, The Very Real Threat of Cyber Terrorism. And we are going to give two books. We're going to get two books to some lucky listeners. So, Mark, do you have a few more minutes?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, go ahead, Mike.
The one area, and I know you, I don't mean this unkindly, I know you have to toe the Microsoft line, but I believe if you're a VP, you get to do what you want to do. You'll say what's on your mind. But as far as rootkits are concerned, I mean, you're the guru of rootkits because you discovered the Sony rootkit and the Sony DRM products back in 2005. And you, in fact, even discovered Rootkit in a product that Symantec released, as I understand it. You're kind of Mr. Rootkit discoverer here.
I do have some experience with rootkits, yep.
Here's my question. I'm trying to be delicate about it. Does Windows absolutely have to make the ability for a company to write a rootkit? Does Windows have to have that vulnerability to be able to work?
Well, the thing is, rootkits it has a very broad definition. It's essentially anything that can hide resources from standard administrative tools or diagnostic tools. And there's so many ways to do that there's really no way to prevent it. And in fact, if you did go out of your way to prevent it, you'd be removing a lot of the value of the operating system itself, a lot of the extensibility of the operating system. I'll just give you one example. Antivirus, for example. Your antivirus software has a kernel driver called a file system filter driver that watches for your apps and you opening files. When you open them, it will open them itself, scan them for viruses, and only if it's clean allow your open to actually proceed successfully. That file system filtering technology is really powerful. And it has to be, but the fact is that you could write a file system filter driver that can hide files from you, same way that the Sony rootkit did. Sony rootkit didn't take advantage of that particular technique. They used a different one to hide the files, but something like a file system filter driver could be used to write a form of rootkit. Not a very sophisticated one, but it's still a rootkit. And so there's really two answers to your question. One is it's really theoretically impossible to completely prevent it. And second, even if you tried to go about closing the most obvious ways to do it, it could be crippling the effectiveness of third-party add-on software that could be developed for good purposes on this system.
Okay. Well, I don't mean this follow-up question unkindly, but I have to ask because it's always a hot topic around here because of some of our co-hosts. How does Apple avoid this vulnerability?
Well, Apple actually doesn't avoid the vulnerability. I mean, they just I'm sure you've talked about this on your show. It's a matter of return on investment for the malware author.
Right.
If Windows is running on 90% of the PCs out there and you want to write a virus you want the maximum return on your investment of time of writing that virus, are you going to write it for the Mac or are you going to write it for Windows? Certainly, if the Mac is on 10% of systems, that's still, you know, a nice juicy target, but it's going to be way secondary to the kind of return that you can get going after the 90%. And so Apple really is in this position today of not being a really juicy target like Windows is, and that's why you see so much of this malware that's just targeting Windows. It's not that the Mac is fundamentally more secure than Windows, because it's not. They've got very similar operating system architectures and very similar security functionality and capabilities. It's purely a matter of what's targeting them and what are people most running and mm-hmm. what kind of malware they're experiencing.
Somehow only the Windows people know that. The Apple people don't admit to that.
That's right.
But let me ask what Mike asked before in a different way about rootkits. Is there any practical reason for the operating system for Windows to allow hidden processes like these?
Well, so there's, like I said, there's so many different ways that you can implement some kind of rootkit-like functionality. And there are some ways that Windows, 64-bit Windows, mm-hmm. starting with Server 2003, prevent. And Dave Cutler, the original architect of Windows NT and DMS, implemented something called kernel patch protection. And he implemented it as a mechanism in the operating system to maintain the stability of the operating system, even against legitimate software. It turns out a lot of legitimate antivirus and security software and value-add software was performing, doing things that look very rootkit-like and that are unsupported by the operating system.
Mm-hmm.
And so he put in this patch guard, another name for kernel patch protection, to stop them from doing those things. One of them is actually, in kernel mode, taking a process off the process list so that it doesn't show up in Task Manager, even though the process really is still there. So that's in effect on any 64-bit version of Windows, which almost all versions of Windows being sold today are 64-bit.
Yeah.
So that is one example where it's just not supported, and so he prevented it. But like I said, for something like a file system filter driver, if we didn't support that, we'd be breaking a lot of legitimate software. We would be preventing a lot of legitimate software from doing really powerful things. And so it just doesn't make sense. I mean, you don't want to cut off your hand to do that, to go to the extreme of not even really fully addressing the problem, because there's so many different ways you can do it. You know, a really easy way to do a rootkit is to infect Task Manager.
No, don't give people any ideas.
He's not going to give away the store. are you going to say, Mark?
Well, there's just so many ways to do it. I mean, the simplest way to do it, and actually Stuxnet does this as its rootkit functionality, is just to sit inside of a process and tamper with the APIs that it's calling. There's absolutely really very little you can do to prevent that kind of behavior.
How effective is Microsoft Security Essentials in preventing a rootkit infection?
Well, it's not heuristic-based. So like almost all antivirus, mainstream antivirus, it's not a behavioral blocking type of solution. So it's not looking for certain patterns and saying, I'm going to block that pattern. It's very difficult to get that kind of solution right without throwing off too many false positives, and a few false positives ruins the user's experience.
Reputation, yeah.
What it is a signature-based solution, and so it's programmed to know about certain types of malware and to block and clean that kind of malware. So if you're talking about how Security Essentials compares to other software of that same kind, what I tell people is, hey, make sure you've got a mainstream antivirus from F-Secure, from Kaspersky, from Symantec, from McAfee, from Microsoft. Any of those are going to be roughly equivalent. At any one point in time, you can throw 1,000 pieces of malware at them, and the percentages that they each catch will be slightly different, but over time, they're going to be equivalent. And so, Security Essentials is right there, and is going to be just as good as those other ones, and be the most effective it can be at blocking the known kinds of attacks. When it comes to something that's brand new, and this is actually how the book Zero Day is, what it's based on, is that antivirus really can't know what's good and what's bad. It can't know the intent of software. And so it's just impossible to block every piece of malicious software that comes on. If it's something that the antivirus people haven't looked at and come up with signatures for, there's just no way to block it. And so that makes an attack like the one that I present in Zero Day feasible, and that is that slow spreading malware, lots of different variants, could infect large numbers of machines underneath the radar of the antivirus companies and carry out the kind of attack that I present. Mm-hmm. It's really, once the malware is on your computer, it's pretty much game over unless it's a simple type of piece of malware. This is what I tell people is, best thing to do is to stop it from getting on your machine in the first place. You should make all efforts to stop it from getting on your machine in the first place, because once it's on there, for example, if it's your credit card information, well, the malware has full access once it's on your machine to all of your personal data, can send it off someplace, can monitor your keystrokes. The damage is mostly done by that point. Cleaning it off is just stopping any further damage, but the bulk of it is already done.
Mark, one of our regular listeners and viewers, Slicky, wants to know if you see Apple or Android being more of a target because of iPad and smartphone markets.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think that's going to, certainly those are becoming more high profile. We've already seen some Android malware on a couple of occasions get out into the Android store, and vulnerabilities in Android also be identified. We've also seen vulnerabilities in the iPhone. At one of these recent hacking contests, somebody found a vulnerability. But certainly, as this explosion of mobile phones, smartphones, where you're going to see hundreds of millions of them sold this year, that also becomes a very attractive target for the bad guys. And so I'm sure that we're just starting to see that kind of attack now.
Mark, just if you need to go, just let us know, please, because we have a lot of stuff to ask you.
Okay. We've only got about 4 more hours of questions, but we'll make it kind of quick.
So, please, feel free to say, hey, guys, I really need to go, and it's fine.
We also want to know when your book is coming out and where it will be available.
Right.
Well, the book actually came out on March 15th, and it's available at most, certainly at the online booksellers, Barnes & Noble, and Amazon, and Powell's Books. Various others. It's also available in most Barnes & Nobles that I've seen.
Is it available?
All of them. And if you go to Barnes & Noble and they don't have it, yell at them, tell them that they're missing out.
Is it available for the Kindle and the like?
It's available for the Kindle.
Good.
Although I get this, a lot of my audience, the people that follow me on SysInternals, live in other countries, Australia and England and Italy, and I just get hammered over and over again because the book isn't available in Kindle form outside of the United States, and unfortunately that's a problem between St. Martin's Press, which is my publisher, and Amazon, who haven't been able to agree on foreign digital distribution rights. So unfortunately those people outside the U.S. don't have a Kindle option. Although, somebody just posted to one of my blogs yesterday that if you live outside the U.S., you can temporarily change your address to inside the U.S., buy it for the Kindle, and then change your address back to the outside the U.S. if you already have a registered Amazon account. So there might be a loophole there.
You know, you just made a comment that reminded me of one of the questions I wanted to ask you when I found out you were going to be on here. When you first started working on fixing Windows problems, at some point, didn't you come very close to the line to being called a hacker?
Yeah, actually I did. So you've been following me that long. I started the NC Internals website, which then became...
I hate to be gushing. I'm a 57-year-old lawyer acting like a schoolgirl, but I have the greatest respect for the work you've done, and people who don't know who you are missing.
Well, thanks. Back in the early days, I was, I did have fun poking Microsoft a little bit. I was writing tools. Like, one of the tools that I wrote was called NT Crash, which simply barraged the kernel system call interface, the APIs, with a bunch of garbage, and then saw what happened. And it turns out that the system wasn't very hardened against bogus inputs, and so I could get the system to crash in numerous different ways. And I published that program on my website. Of course, that didn't make Microsoft very happy. But back then, the world was very different, and whereas today, those would all be seen as security vulnerabilities, elevation of privilege holes. Back then, it was simply a poor programming kind of thing. But the thing that got me in the deepest water with Microsoft was in 1996, NT4 was coming out, and NT4 was the first version of Windows NT that had bundled with it web server called IIS, of course. The workstation version of NT had personal web services, which was a version of IIS, for workstation, and there was a thriving web server third-party software market out there at the time. O'Reilly had a web server, Netscape had a web server, and so when Microsoft announced that it was bundling a web server, these companies got really annoyed. And what they wanted to do then was say, well, if you're going to be bundling IIS with server, and server's so much more expensive, we want to target workstation people to buy our web server software, because workstation is less, and even if they buy our web server, it's still going to be less than Windows NT server. The problem with that was that Microsoft was setting a limit on the number of concurrent connections to workstations of 10 concurrent TCP/IP connections. And you really, unless you've got a toy kind of website, you're going to be exceeding that limit. At one point in the NT4 beta cycle, the code actually hard prevented more than that number of connections. They removed that in a later release candidate. But that raised the question of why was Microsoft preventing more than 10 connections on workstations? And Microsoft's marketing came out and wrote an article that said, hey, this is for your own good. Workstation is different than server, just not capable of handling web server loads of more than 10 connections. And so we're putting this restriction in for technical reasons. And one of my friends of mine, Andrew Shulman, who you might have heard of, he wrote a book called Undocumented DOS back then and Unauthorized Windows 95. He worked at O'Reilly at the time and asked me if I knew what the difference between workstation and server was. So I went and took a look at them, reverse engineered the differences, and it turns out that even today, workstation and server, or today it's be professional or home, whatever, and the server versions of Windows NT were identical. The differences were really just some extra add-on software that was available with server, not in workstation, and some registry values. One of the registry values says to the system whether it's a server or a workstation. So what I did was write a program called NTTune that would flip workstation into server or vice versa. And I sent it to PC Week, who was one of the magazines, today T Week, that was following this story. They did their web server benchmark, I think it was called WebBench, on Windows NT server. Then they did it on Windows NT workstation. Then they flipped the workstation into a server and did the same test using NTTune and came out with the same numbers. So it proved that workstation and server were really same. It was just this registry value affecting the behavior, and that got me in all sorts of hot water with Microsoft. And I think that that's what, if Microsoft was definitely calling me a hacker at that point.
And disliked it so much they bought the company.
I got my first job offer from Microsoft was because of that. Microsoft already back then was in the, can't beat them.
Mark, let me take it in a different direction for a second. Spam.
Yep.
In my real life, I'm an internet service provider. And I know for a fact that there is a way to stop spam, or most of it, through the correct dialogue between servers.
Like sender ID?
By what?
Sender ID? Is that what you're referring to?
I don't know that if that word comes into it. If there is a, and I'm not the best technical guy, but I know for a fact that there is a way that you can refuse email or connection from a mail server that is not registered as a mail server.
Right.
And we tried to implement it one time, and I ended up spending days calling reputable companies and telling them that their mail servers were not configured correctly, and that's why we are not accepting their email. After that, I mean, it was impractical to use it. And it seems that if a company like Microsoft or like Google, or I mean, a big email user will enforce it, then the rest will follow suit. And really, I mean, it's already built into the system. It's just that it's like, okay, well, if you didn't configure your email server correctly, we forgive you. It's fine. Just keep on going. And the guys who are sending the emails are sending them as unknown servers and things like that. To go a step even farther is just like DNSs are registered on the net, mail servers could be registered and verified by somebody who I'm sure will jump on this, just like the blacklists maintainers. And we stopped most of the spam right there in its tracks. Why doesn't that happen? Or is this something that you ever heard about before?
Yeah, I've heard about it, actually. And you know that Microsoft is hugely interested in and concerned about this problem. I mean, Microsoft servers handle enormous amounts of spam all the time. Mm-hmm. And Bill Gates at some point made a prediction that spam was going to be eliminated and focused a lot of research at Microsoft on addressing that problem. And so the system that you're talking about actually Microsoft contributed to. The problem with turning it on and enforcing it is that you're going to break the term people use is break the internet. There's so many servers out there that are sending email that gets propped up to send email that if you turn that thing on, and this is what you experience, that email stops flowing because you just can't reach all of the people that are creating mail servers and force them to participate in the system. I think it's one of those things. You'll see this in the credit card industry with the example of your card being swiped. Is that there are solutions to that problem that you experienced that resulted in your card being stolen, but the cost to the system itself, as it exists today, is considered higher than the cost of the problem that it's going to address. And so the cost of breaking the internet for some period of time to address the spam problem is considered higher than the cost of the spam. And the same thing with the cost of the solution to prevent what happened to your card.
An example, I think, of where Mark is exactly right, of course, is that if you look at the military, if you don't have a perfectly formulated header when you send email to the military on their secure servers, you don't have a hope of getting email to the intended person.
Yeah, so there's certain environments that can lock it down, and they're more concerned about the security of the system than the cost of what they might break in the process of somebody tries to send them email, they can't get through. Oh, well.
Well, I don't know. It seems like anybody that has an actual mail server has an IT person that can do it, and if they realize, it's not working right, we need to fix it, they'll fix it. They'll do their job. Right now, they don't have to do their job. They say, okay, everything is working. I'm not going to touch it. But anyway, I just thought I'd bring it up.
Yeah, right. I don't think there's a silver bullet kind of answer to that. And I do agree with you that kind of intuitively it seems like that you should just be able to turn it on and everybody would snap to the right thing. But
yeah.
The other problem is how do you, these guys, you're verifying them. Let me give you an analogy for another example of where Microsoft tried to shift the industry and that is signing code, digitally signing software.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's very similar. It's basically on a web server, a mail server, you've got to go and register someplace to be an authorized mail server. Would that cost time and money and an infrastructure to support that? And are you going to be letting bad mail servers that are sending spam into the system anyway? You don't have really tight oversight over what's going on. Well, code signing was Microsoft's drive several years ago with AuthentiCode to get people to sign their code, their ActiveX control. And a lot of people, even still today, a lot of ISVs don't do it. Microsoft could have made it so that unsigned software just doesn't work, but they would have broken Windows if they'd done that.
Mm-hmm.
So much existing software out there that isn't signed, that preventing unsigned software from running just wouldn't work. And then you've got something like what happened with the Komodo certificate thefts from a couple weeks ago.
Right.
That undermined the whole credibility of the system.
Yep.
In the first place, that would be the same thing on the spam server side of spam web, spam mail servers getting registered as legitimate servers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mark, where can people who want to know more about you and the work you're doing, I know you have a blog. Where is the blog, and are there other outlets for your great wisdom?
Sure. The blog is on the SysInternals website. There's a long official Microsoft URL, but the easy one to remember, which is the one I use, is just sysinternals.com. That still works. And so my blog is off there, off the left menu, Mark's blog. In fact, I don't know if you've seen, but speaking of Stuxnet, which is a fascinating piece of malware, considered some of the most sophisticated malware ever released, and likely the first nation-state sponsored malware. I just published last week a part one of an analysis of Stuxnet using the SysInternals tools, Stuxnet infection. So that's on my blog. And then more information about the book, including a book blog, where I talk about cyber news and stuff related to the book, is on at www.zerodaythebook.com.
Zero Day the Book?
Yes, zerodaythebook.com.
Yeah, excellent.
Good.
Good.
We're going to put some links on our site. Okay. Anything else you wanted to add?
No. Thanks very much for having me. It's been a fun conversation.
Yeah. Same here. Mike?
Well, I'll shut up now.
Okay.
I mean, again, I just.
You can go for 4 hours.
Or more. I hope Mark will embrace the new media and consider getting a weekly or monthly show similar to this one where he hosts the show and he controls the content and can get out the information, because I would absolutely be a subscriber. Because what people don't know, Amnon, is that Mark has dramatically improved the quality of the life of every person who touches a Windows computer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, his effect has been that far reaching, and which one would be the more important one at any point in time, who knows, but he's a pioneer. He's really at the top of the game.
Thanks, Mike. And that's incredibly rewarding to hear something like that.
You deserve it.
Yes, thank you for all you've done.
Thank you, Mark.
No, thanks, Amnon.
And have a great weekend, whatever is left of it. Where are you?
In Seattle.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, go have your morning coffee now.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Take care. Bye-bye.